You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Good morning, everyone. Everyone's welcome. Whatever your background, sexuality, ethnicity, gender, you are welcome here. And we acknowledge that we're on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people. We respect their elders, past and present. I mention also some notices. First of all, moving meditation has stopped moving. So there'll be no more moving meditation on Mondays until further notice. Finally, I want to thank the people who have pledged some support for a potential refugee family that we might look after under a new government program. So we did say by the end of August, so this is last chance in the next few days. If you want to let Mary know, email or telephone call or whatever, if you think you could allocate time or funds to such a project, let us know, and then probably the next committee of management meeting will make a decision whether to go ahead with that or not. But certainly I thank people for the support that's been suggested so far. Next Sunday, apart from meeting here in the morning, there will also be a Vespers service at Shady Grove up in the hills at 4 p.m. It has been mentioned before, but now that we have a new website, it's worth looking at if you haven't seen it already. And please note that the newsletter is not going away. It's not being presented on the website, but it's going to be emailed out to you with the notices. So there's no sort of restriction on it, but it's, for many people, a more convenient way to get it by email, and then you've got it stored there for when you want it. The other thing to mention is the Catherine Helen Spence Oration. That is booked for 9th of November. More details to follow. Anyone who has a good strong back to help with clearing the views out from the hall for carpet cleaning on Monday. If people want to help, what time should they be here? Yes. 1 p.m. Okay. 1 p.m. Yes. Perfect. I think that's probably all for now. Everyone knows that if they want to, they can make a donation in the foyer after the event this morning. But most importantly, you're here. And so, as is our custom, I light this flame on this chalice. It becomes the focal point that we gather around, and hoping that after this hour together as a community we leave with more understanding and a greater commitment to be kind to each other and those outside. And now a poem from the poet Hafiz. Helen's going to read that for us this morning.
I have learned so much from God that I no longer call myself a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. The truth has shared so much of itself with me that I can no longer call myself a man, a woman, an angel, or even pure soul. Love has befriended Hafiz so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known.
Now we sing a hymn for the day. We tried it last week. May I be filled with loving kindness. Thank you. And now, as is our custom, we can present to each other joys or concerns that we have experienced through the week. I would like to light the first candle. And now I'll ask John Hall to come up with a reading.
This is from the Persian poet Rumi, from a collection called Mesnavi. Love is clearly shown by the heart's unfulfilled longing. There isn't any sickness like the sickness of the heart. The sickness of the lover is distinct from other illnesses. Love is the measuring device of the secrets of God. Whether a lover is from this or that origin, eventually love is our guide to the divine. However I describe and explain love, when I reach love itself, I am ashamed of the inadequate description. Although the explanation by speech illuminates, love expressed without speech is clearer. The pen was hurrying to describe love. When it reached love, it shattered itself. In explaining love, the intellect gets stuck like a donkey in the mud. Only love can explain both love and being in love. The sun is the demonstration of the sun. If you need proof, seek it from the sun. Don't turn your face away.
Well, if I was listening to Rumi, I might just offer 20 minutes of silence, like our friends the Quakers. But I am asked to offer some reflections. So here we go. The question is how much you know about Islam. Now, I think it's important for us to have at least a working knowledge of Islam for two reasons. One is that our increased understanding helps us deal with others with respect and potentially to free us from any prejudice we might have. And goodness knows there's plenty of conditioning coming from TV, social media and so on, which is conditioning us in a certain direction. And secondly, we can't ignore recent political history. I don't want to labour the point about Australia being a political satellite of the US, but it is a fact that US military and foreign policy has a pervasive impact on the cultural references which we receive in Australia. And after the 2001 attack on the Twin Towers in New York, the War on Terror was declared by the US. And it was translated in many parts of the world as a war on Muslims. And indeed, George Bush Jr. announced that America would be embarking on a crusade against those responsible for the 9/11 attack. And he soon pulled back from that language, possibly because he was advised that it might inflame anti-Christian sentiment around the world. And it may have been that he was advised that the Crusades of 800 to 1,000 years ago actually didn't end well for the invaders. Anyway, the inevitable war propaganda and the divisiveness of the Murdoch press and social media flooded Australia with anti-Muslim messages and fears. And unfortunately, many totally innocent Muslim Australians suffered as a result. In my own little part of the world, in Marion, for example, there were many local Muslims who suffered name-calling and even assaults on the street, women having their hijabs pulled off, for example. So it's against this background. I think it's important to have some understanding of Islam. Let's go back to the time of Arabia 1400 years ago, where there were numerous tribes across the Arabian Peninsula, most of them polytheistic, and many of their gods represented forces of nature, such as water or the sun. People would pray to those gods and make sacrifices to them in order to seek favour from them. And although many of the different belief systems would have been comparable and would have had similar religious practices, there was in fact great diversity in the Arabian Peninsula itself. And some of those tribes were even monotheists, perhaps influenced by Jewish monotheism. And it was into this setting that Muhammad arrived. As with the life of Yeshua, or Jesus, one must be cautious in setting out a biography of Muhammad, because we have nothing preserved that was not recorded at least several generations after the life of Muhammad. So bearing in mind that Muhammad lived about 600 years after Yeshua, there is a little more documentary material, but none of it written by people who were alive when Muhammad was alive. Unlike the Christian Bible stories about Jesus, the Quran says practically nothing about the life of Muhammad. In any case, it seems most likely that Muhammad was born into a significant family in the year 570 in the Common Era, but he was orphaned early in life. Raised by relatives, tradition has it that he regularly spent time alone in contemplation and prayer. He married into a wealthy family. It is said that he was a successful trader. And his life changed at the age of 40 when, during one of his solitary periods of contemplation, the angel Gabriel imparted messages of God to him. And Muhammad began proclaiming these messages publicly. The essence of the revelations was that there is but one God, and the ideal way to live was in complete submission to God. Islam literally means submission. The revelations continued intermittently over many years. The Jewish influence on Muhammad's thinking should not be underestimated. There were many Jews living in the Arabian cities in the 7th century. The Jewish concepts of a weekly time of communal prayer, dietary restrictions, including prohibition on eating meat of the pig, judgment day when all souls would be finally approved or not, all of these became incorporated into the messages recorded in the Quran. In one sense, Muhammad's message was more radical in the context of Arabian culture than Yeshua's message in that earlier time and place. Yeshua spoke of God within his Jewish context. Muhammad gave his monotheistic teaching surrounded by tribes holding polytheistic beliefs, many of which responded with hostility. The year 622 was highly significant. When Muhammad was about 52 years old, he and his followers migrated from Mecca to Medina. In fact, the Islamic calendar commences from that year. Muhammad and his followers grew in strength, and the monotheistic message went out across the Arabian Peninsula. After 7 years in Medina, Muhammad returned with an army to Mecca and re-established himself there. He died soon after. On the screen, there is a depiction of Muhammad's name in Arabic script. One of the consequences of Muhammad's message of strict monotheism was that idols and images of God became unacceptable. This explains why, if you go into a mosque, you'll see elaborate Arabic script and amazing geometrical designs, but you won't see any images representing Muhammad or divinity itself. After Muhammad's death, it was decided by his successor that the revelations provided by Muhammad should be compiled. Documents were examined, and many of those who had memorized verses given by Muhammad came forward to recite what they recalled. The various verses were compiled, but no thought had been given along the way to dating the divine messages given by Muhammad when they were uttered. It was therefore deemed judicious to set out the messages in order from largest to smallest. This was arbitrary, but at the time there was no other obvious way of sorting them out. There are different tones and concerns in various of the sayings, suggestive of the different periods of Muhammad's life, some reflecting tension in Mecca, some reflecting success in Medina, and so on. So it is possible to reconstruct a version of the Quran, placing the messages in chronological order. For the student of Islam, it can be useful to read it that way, although it's obviously not the official version. How can we summarise the message of the Quran? For the majority of Muslims, known as Sunni Muslims, there are said to be five pillars of Islam. First of all, there's the profession of faith. So the Christian equivalent might be the Nicene Creed. For Muslims, it is simply this: there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. Anyone who can state that without reservation or qualification is a Muslim. You can see that there are two essential elements in that statement of faith. There can only be one God. The implication is that any idols or images of God, anyone who claims to be God, anyone walking around in human form claiming to be God, or any God believed to be part of a pantheon of gods, such as in India or ancient Greece, cannot be God. The other element of the profession of faith there is that Muhammad is the messenger of God. In other words, all you need to know about God can be derived from the revelations according to Muhammad. He is acknowledged as a prophet, not as a divine being. Beyond the strict monotheism and copious ethical instructions for the believers, the Quran establishes four duties for Muslims. So I'll go through them in the literal sense, but these practical obligations can also be contemplated esoterically. Let's consider the obligation of prayer. It is customary for most Muslims to pray five times a day, and these times are set according to the sun and the moon, the most reliable and universal measures of time in Muhammad's day. Essentially, the prayers are to be said at dawn, after midday, late afternoon, at sunset, and once night has fallen. And the tradition of the whole congregation gathering for prayer on Fridays goes back to a reference in the Quran. The Quran is also the basis for the obligation of charity, whether this be organised giving through the mosque, or it could be directly giving aid to poor people, people with disabilities, and so on, whether locally or further afield. You've probably all heard of Ramadan. This is a month of fasting. Fasting is taken on as a religious obligation, a test of faith and discipline. Usually this entails not taking any food between sunrise and sunset during the month of Ramadan. But some take it even more strictly. I remember when I was visiting asylum seeker clients in Woomera, in temperatures of 35 or 40 degrees. In the interview rooms, which were very simple, they weren't air-conditioned initially, a table and a couple of chairs, water, glasses, that was it. And I remember offering to pour water for client after client, only to have them refuse. And I couldn't understand it until it dawned on me that it was Ramadan, and most of the Muslim clients wouldn't even accept water during the daylight hours, despite the heat. You've probably also heard of Muslims travelling to Mecca. The obligation to make a pilgrimage there, because of the significance of the place to Muhammad, is usually expressed as an obligation that one must make the trip at least once in a lifetime. For Shia Muslims, in addition to prayer, charity, fasting, and pilgrimage, other obligations are also drawn from the Quran. For example, the concept of moral and physical purity is stressed. Another essential item listed by the Shia is what I would translate as authority, meaning recognition of the authority of the imams, who have a function like priests in the Catholic and Orthodox forms of Christian religion. It is a recognition that there is a hierarchy and some better able to interpret the Quran and the ways of God better than others. For the Shia, there's also the concept of striving, which is notorious in the Western world in its original Arabic form, jihad. Essentially, it is a concept of struggle or striving, referring to one's inner striving for purity, exemplary conduct, and closeness to God. Striving to overcome the ego, one might say. Unfortunately, like various religious concepts in a range of different religions, the concept has been hijacked for political purposes and interpreted literally to mean carrying on warfare against political enemies. I want to explain to you some of the divergent sects in the Muslim world. Many of you would have heard of the division of Muslim believers into Sunni and Shia. Sunni make up about 80% of all of the Muslims in the world. However, the Shia continue to have a significant presence. The division stemmed from a dispute about who should be at the head of the Muslim organisation, politically and theologically, some decades after the death of Muhammad. After some debate, one of the favoured companions of Muhammad was selected as the first successor. The second leader was selected without great debate. After being fatally wounded, as he was dying, he appointed a committee of six to select the next leader. When in turn the third leader was assassinated, Ali became leader. Ali was both a cousin and son-in-law of Muhammad. By that time, Arabic expansion had spread to Syria and beyond. The governor in Syria, Muawiyah, did not accept Ali's leadership. They fought, but entered into a temporary truce, during which time Ali was assassinated. Muawiyah assumed leadership of what became Sunni Muslims. The followers of Ali, in Arabic Shi'at Ali, abbreviated to Shia, continued to agitate for return to the line of dynastic succession through Ali. And that position remains unchanged to this day. So it was not because of theological differences that the two groups became separate, but rather that having been separated, they gradually developed different traditions and emphasis over time. The significant difference became the Shia emphasis on the authority of the Imam. The line of succession after Muawiyah developed a substantial body of literature to fill in all the gaps concerning ethical conduct and the finer points of theology not fully explored in the Quran. These writings, known as the Hadith, are the equivalent of the Talmud for Jewish believers. They set out the traditions to be followed. The Arabic word for traditions is Sunnah, so the followers of this branch of Islam are Sunni. These two main branches of Islam developed separate empires, which had distinct boundaries in the so-called Age of Gunpowder Empires, the period when armies began to be equipped with gunpowder-fired cannons. The remnants of these old empires continue today in the form of Shia dominance in Iran, while the Sunni dominate in Saudi Arabia and other countries. And I have a slide on the screen showing Shia population versus Sunni population elsewhere. Just as in Christianity and most religions, innovations developed over time. As Islamic philosophers pondered the nature of God, the influence of Neoplatonism was substantial, particularly among the Ismaili and Druze sects. The Sufi movement developed in response to the lavish lifestyle of Islamic rulers. It could be seen as a parallel to the Protestant movement in Christianity. Those who sought to regain the purity and simplicity of Muhammad's message wore nothing but simple woolen garments. The Arabic for wool is suf. They became known as Sufis. So now I'm going to do something dangerous and ask for questions. Does anyone have any questions? The question was about Wahhabism. So within the Sunni and Shia division, remembering that Sunni is the majority, it can't be taken that one is necessarily stricter than the other. And both claim to have all of their traditions and precepts derived from the Quran. The Wahhabism arose as a particularly strict form I suppose, a return to literalism within the Sunni population, and particularly based in Arabia. I suppose if we were trying to draw a Christian equivalent, it might be Calvinism, or possibly what they call Bible Christians, meaning that we take it all literally. And so it's a particularly strict interpretation originating in Saudi Arabia. Yes. So Islam vis-a-vis women. The important thing to stress here is that Muhammad was giving his utterances at a time of almost completely patriarchal society. Thus, as you might find in the teachings of Paul, for example, in the Christian tradition, you have the Quran essentially addressed to men and for women to take the role of being primarily at home. So beyond that, you'll find that most of the, what some might say, subjugation of women comes back to cultural impositions upon women. And in many parts of the world, that'll be justified by some references in the Quran. For example, there's a line in the Quran about women being settled at home, or in, could be interpreted, staying at home. Certainly there are references to being modest in appearance and going about with your cloak around you. There's that idea, which we're also familiar with from medieval Christianity, that if women appear too attractive, that it might tempt men, as if that's women's fault. Having said that, there's also an imposition on men to treat women justly. So I think you'll find that most of the objectionable behaviour you see is actually cultural rather than a commandment as such. The Taliban, ironically, are Sunni as well. So once again, whether it's Sunni or Shia, you can't assume that someone is more moderate or more strict or more literal or more interpretive because of those divisions. So in Afghanistan, for example, there are a number of Hazara who for a long time have been Shia adherents, and they get a very hard time from the Taliban. So that's where the Taliban fit in, and obviously they're fundamentalists, which people here would not find attractive in any religion or denomination, I'm sure. The Sunni-Shia divide, looking in the crystal ball, well, the Shia are such a significant minority that one can only foresee that they'll be around with us for a long time yet. But you'll find that where there are differences, conflict, persecution vis-a-vis Sunni and Shia, you will usually find there is political motivation, in other words, somebody seeking power or territory behind it. So right, as we've seen right through history, whatever the prevailing religion might be, those who seek worldly power and territory will use religion as a cloak. And if we are going to examine the ways of the world at all, we need to uncover that and separate out those who are sincere in religion, who work towards being peaceful and more loving, as against those who want to use religion, usually in a destructive way, to achieve power. Comments are always dangerous, but yeah, go ahead. So the comment there is about, although there are some good examples among Muslims, there are also people who are, in a sense, of taking advantage, again, on a very personal level, of the religion to assert power in personal relationships. So just the previous question was talking about the grand geopolitical scene, but the same abuse of religion can occur on an individual level as well. I'll just take two more. So there's a comment there about dress codes and so on. You'll find that there's very little that is highly specific in the Quran, but there are a lot of people who culturally will endeavour to dress like people did in the time of Muhammad to reflect the teaching, but it's not necessarily the teaching. Once again, with dress, you'll find that a lot of it is cultural. And one final question. The significance of the Quran and reports of the Quran being burnt in different places as a provocation or an act of hatred, however you interpret it. There does seem to be a particularly passionate response to have the holy book burnt, and I guess you can all make a judgment. Would that be the same if a Bible was burnt in Alabama? I don't know. But obviously people get upset about it. It's obviously disrespectful, whichever way you look at it. And I suppose the challenge for people who are on the spiritual path is, what do you do in the face of that sort of disrespect? How do you respond? And generally, violence and aggression is counterproductive. So what we're trying to do is actually increase understanding and hope that that has some positive effect. I'd like to conclude with some thoughts about those obligations cast on Muslims by the Quran. How might they be relevant to us now? So, for example, with prayer. Now, we have a diversity of religious beliefs in this group. Some might pray to a god or transcendent being. Others may not. But the question is, do we find the time in our busy lives to sit in contemplation and be at peace with ourselves, to resolve those feelings of annoyance and aggression that we have in relation to other people? Pilgrimage can be seen in a similar vein. Now, there's no Unitarian shrine, so nobody's recommending that we travel across the world to visit Unitarians somewhere else. But the question is, do we have a place we can go to which has a sense of holiness, or at least spiritual peace, for us? It might be a particular building where people have worshipped for centuries. It might be a place of nature where we can get that sense of the spirit of life, whatever that might be. And fasting. Do we consciously refrain from those things which are unhealthy for us? What strength can we get from our Unitarian understanding to restrain ourselves from that which is unhealthy for us? In a way, it makes it easy for the human mind to say, well, for 1 month of the year, we're not going to eat during daylight hours. But what are we going to do for the rest of the year? And I don't mean Muslims, I mean us. What can we do to remind ourselves to pull back from addictions or simply things that are unhealthy for us? And in terms of charity as well. You know, there are many Christian churches as well as in the Muslim world where they talk about tithes, certain percentages, you should give a certain amount. We don't do that. But there certainly is an obligation on us, if we're on the spiritual path, to be generous to those less well off than ourselves. So there is a question for you. How are you being charitable in the coming week and in your life? We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians, or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.